want. Otherwise, we would owe you. In the more standard jargon of socialism, Mao claimed that Peng and his supporters were bourgeois democrats who had little in common with the proletarian socialist revolution, thereby stripping them of their positions and casting them into the ranks of the bourgeoisie. At the closing meeting of the conference 5 days later, a resolution was adopted in which Mao's opponents were found guilty of having conspired against party, state, and people. The next few months would unleash a nationwide witch hunt against rightist elements. Chapter 13. Repression. The army was purged. Lin Biao, who could be depended on to ferret out any ideological opposition among the military, was rewarded for his performance at Lushan with Peng Dehuai's job. Lin knew that speaking the truth about conditions in the countryside was a naive approach bound to fail, and he showered the chairman with flattery instead. But in private, he was much more critical than Peng, confiding in his private diary, unearthed by Red Guards years later, that the great leap forward was based on fantasy and a total mess. Rarely was the distance between a leader's inner thoughts and his public statements so vast. But all over the country, party officials scrambled to prove their allegiance to the chairman, and the great leap forward as a new purge unfolded. The tone was set at the top. In language auguring the Cultural Revolution, Peng Jun beat the drum for a purge of the ranks. "The struggle should be profound, and should be carried out according to our principles, whether it is against old comrades in arms, colleagues, or even husbands and wives." Tan Junlin, the zealous vice premier overseeing agriculture, pointed out that enemies were entrenched at the very top. "This struggle should separate us from some of our old comrades in arms." In Beijing alone, thousands of top officials were targeted by the end of 1959, including almost 300 up to the level of Central Committee member, or 10% of the top echelon. More than 60 were branded as rightists. Many were old veterans. But as the leadership explained, they had to be smashed resolutely, or else the construction of socialism would be imperiled. Across the country, anybody who had expressed reservations about the Great Leap Forward was hunted down. In Gansu, this struggle started as soon as Zhang Zhongliang returned to Lanzhou. Huo Weida, Song Langcheng, and others who had shot a poisoned arrow at Lushan were denounced as members of an anti-party clique. Well over 10,000 cadres were hounded throughout the province. Where his rivals had revealed widespread famine in a letter of denunciation to Beijing, Zhang wrote instead to the chairman, "Work in every department is surging ahead in our province. The changes are momentous, including those concerning grain. We are looking at a bumper harvest across the province." Then, as his realm turned into a living hell in 1960, he wrote again to explain deaths by starvation, blaming them on Huo Weida, the leader of the anti-party clique. Zhang minimized what would later be revealed to be death on a massive scale, by again calling it a problem of one finger out of 10. Anybody who had stood in the path of the Great Leap Forward was removed. In Yunnan, the deputy of the Bureau for Commerce was dismissed for having made critical comments about food shortages and the people's communes, and for having snored while recordings of the chairman's speeches were being played. In Hebei, the vice director of the Bureau for Water Conservancy was purged for having expressed doubts about the wisdom of dismantling central heating systems during the steel campaign. County leaders who had started to close some of the canteens were persecuted for abandoning socialism and reverting to a go-it-alone policy. In Anhui, Vice-Governor Zhang Kaifan and some of his allies were sacked, as Mao suspected that such people are speculators who sneaked into the party. They schemed to sabotage the proletarian dictatorship, split the party and organize factions. Similar high-level dismissals also occurred in Fujian, Qingqiai, Heilongjiang, and Yangning, among other provinces. Provincial leaders who had managed to soften the impact of the Great Leap Forward were removed. Under constant fire from Mao and his acolytes for his caution, Zhu Xiaochu, the reluctant leader of Henan province, had relented and inflated the crop projections in 1958. But he rarely lost an opportunity to put a damper on the enthusiasm of local cadres during inspection trips. In Chengde, he had openly scoffed at all the bragging about grain output. He questioned the supply system. Approached by a woman who complained about the local canteen, he had suggested that she simply walk out and cook a meal back home. He had refused point-blank to have anybody in Henan follow the example set by Ma Cheng, seeing the Sputnik fields as a dangerous diversion from pressing agricultural tasks. In Ningxiang, where he had discovered that only women were working in the fields, he had demanded that the menfolk be recalled from the backyard furnaces. His response to the work-study program, requiring all students in primary schools to participate in productive labor, had been a mere expletive. Rubbish. Despite his best efforts, many local cadres had forged ahead, embracing the leap forward through a mixture of conviction and ambition, leading to the same kind of abuses on the ground as could be found elsewhere. But all in all, Hunan was in better shape than its neighbour, Hubei, run by Mao's sycophant, Wang Renzong. When Mao's special train had stopped in Wuchang in May 1959, just before the Lushan meeting, the city was in a terrible state. Even in the guesthouse set aside for Mao, there was no meat, no cigarettes, and few vegetables. Changsha, in Mao's home province of Hunan, was different, with open-air restaurants still serving customers. Zhu Xiaochu was all too conscious of the contrast, prodding his rival Wang, who was accompanying Mao to Changsha. Hunan was criticized for not having worked as hard. Now look at Hubei. You don't even have stale cigarettes or tea. You used up all your reserves last year. Today we may be poor, but at least we have supplies in storage. With hindsight, maybe Zhou had too many enemies to survive in the fierce environment of a one-party regime. As a key member of the anti-party clique, he was purged immediately after the Lushan plenum, paving the way for leaders like Jiang Pinghua, who were willing to follow Mao's every dictate and starve the local population as a result. Whatever remnants of reason had managed to survive the folly of the Great Leap Forward were swept aside in a frenzied witch hunt which left farmers more vulnerable than ever to the naked power of the party. At every level, province, county, commune, brigade, ferocious purges were carried out, replacing lackluster cadres with hard, unscrupulous elements who trimmed their sails to benefit from the radical winds blowing from Beijing. In 1959-60, some 3.6 million party members were labelled or purged as rightists, although total membership surged from 13,960,000 in 1959 to 17,380,000 in 1961. In a moral universe in which the means justified the ends, many would be prepared to become the chairman's willing instruments, casting aside every idea about right and wrong to achieve the ends he envisaged. Had the leadership reversed course in the summer of 1959 at Lushan, the number of victims claimed by famine would have been counted in the millions. Instead, as the country plunged into catastrophe, tens of millions of lives would be extinguished through exhaustion, illness, torture, and hunger. War on the people was about to take on a wholly new dimension as the leadership looked away, finding in the growing rift with the Soviet Union a perfect pretext to turn a blind eye to what was happening on the ground. Chapter 14. the Sino-Soviet Rift. Mikhail Klotchko received his recall telegram on the 16th of July 1960. Together with some 1,500 Soviet advisers and 2,500 dependents, he was ordered to pack up and leave by his embassy in Beijing. His hosts were courteous to the last, having been instructed to provide every assistance possible, as well as to obtain, by any means possible, all the technical information that the Russians had not already handed over. At a banquet for the departing advisers, Foreign Minister Chen Yi thanked them warmly for their immense help and wished them good health. On a more sour note, a Soviet delegate complained, "We've done so much for you, and you are not content." After Mao had initiated an international crisis by shelling Kwe Moi and Matsu 2 years earlier, Khrushchev started to reconsider his offer to deliver a sample atom bomb to China. Nuclear disarmament talks between the Soviet Union and the United States prompted him to delay honoring his pledge, and in June 1959 he finally reneged on his promise altogether. In late September 1959, at a summit between the USA and the Soviet Union, Khrushchev agreed to a reduction of 1 million in the total number of Soviet troops, seeking a further rapprochement with the United States. Relations further deteriorated when Khrushchev visited Beijing a few months later to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the People's Republic. The Soviet delegation clashed with their hosts over a series of issues, including a border dispute between China and India, as Moscow attempted to act as an intermediary between the two countries instead of backing its ally Beijing. In the spring of 1960, Beijing started openly to challenge Moscow for the right to lead the socialist camp, denouncing Khrushchev in increasingly vituperative terms for his revisionism and his pursuit of appeasement with imperialists. Angered, the Soviet leader retaliated by pulling all Soviet advisers out of China. The withdrawal came as a blow to Mao. It led to the collapse of economic relations between the two countries, the cancellation of scores of large-scale projects, and a freeze in high-end military technology transfers. As Jung Chung and John Halliday point out in Mao, The Unknown Story, the population should have benefited from these cancellations, as less food would now have to be exported to pay for expensive projects. But where the agreements allowed for repayments to be made over 16 years, Mao insisted on settling up ahead of schedule. Times were really tough in Yan'an during the war. We ate hot peppers and nobody died, and now that things are much better than in those days, we want to fasten our belts and try to pay the money back within 5 years. On the 5th of August 1960, even before the departure of all Soviet specialists was completed, provincial leaders were warned by phone that the country was not exporting enough, as it was heading towards a deficit in the balance of payments of 2 billion yuan. Every effort had to be made to honour the Soviet debt within 2 years, and this had to be done by increasing exports of grain, cotton, and edible oils as much as possible. The true scale of early repayments to the Soviet Union has only just come to light with the opening of the archives in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beijing, where an army of accountants kept detailed records of how shifting exchange rates, the changing gold content of the ruble, renegotiations of trade agreements, and the calculation of interest rates affected repayments to the Soviet Union. They show that Moscow lent some 968.6 million rubles to Beijing between 1950 and 1955, not including interest. By the time of the recall of Soviet experts, some 430.3 million rubles was still owed. But as a consequence of the trade deficit, further loans were contracted during the following years, and by the end of 1962, the total owed by Beijing stood at 1,407 million rubles, 1,275 million in loans, plus interest estimated at 132 million. Some 1,269 million of this was amortized by 1962. In other words, while the total debt increased from 968 to 1,407 million rubles, China managed to pay off roughly half a billion between 1960 and 1962, as tens of millions of Chinese died of famine. It may be that this amount was actually smaller, as the figure provided for 1960 did not include interest, which was presumably repaid on top of capital. But even if we allow for a correction of 10%, the fact remains that large sums of money were paid to the Soviet Union. In 1960, some 160 million rubles were sent to clear part of the debt, while in 1962, about 172 million rubles were returned. The figure for 1961 is missing, but it is likely to be similar. Large amounts of exports were also used to amortize the debt, meaning that by the end of 1962, China owed the Soviet Union only 138 million rubles. China insisted on paying 97 million in 1963, clearing the debt by 1965. But the Russians never asked for an accelerated repayment. On the contrary, they agreed in April 1961 that 288 million rubles in unpaid balances should be refinanced as a new credit, with the payments taking place over 4 years, the first in 1962 being no more than 8 million. As the moratorium on the trade deficit worked like an unplanned loan, it actually meant that China was given more economic aid by the Soviet Union than any other country had received during a single year to date. The real damage done to the economy by the recall of all experts was minor, since few civilian specialists worked in agriculture. And even if some industrial projects were delayed by the withdrawal of foreign expertise, the economy at this stage was already in deep trouble. But Mao conveniently blamed the Soviet Union for China's economic collapse, starting one of the most enduring myths about the famine, namely that hunger was caused by Soviet pressure to pay back the debts. Already in November 1960, China invoked natural catastrophes as well as the immense damage done to the entire economy by the Soviet recall to explain delays in the delivery of foodstuffs to East Germany. In 1964, Mikhail Suslov, the chief ideologue in foreign policy in Moscow, noted that China blamed the Soviet Union for the famine. To this day, when ordinary people who survived the famine are asked what, in their opinion, caused mass starvation, the answer almost invariably points to the Soviet Union. This is how a farmer from Chaoqing, near the Hong Kong border, explained the famine in a recent interview. "The government owed the Soviet Union a huge sum of money and needed to repay the loans. A very huge sum of loans. So all the produce in the country had to be submitted. All the livestock and the grain had to be given out to the government to repay the loans to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union forced China to repay the loans." Did the recall of foreign advisers hasten the adoption of policies in China designed to tackle the famine? Few observers, at the time or to this day, see it in that light. Khrushchev is roundly blamed for having shot himself in the foot. Overnight, the Soviet leader threw away whatever leverage he had over China. Especially scathing of their leader were Russian diplomats serving in Beijing at the time. For instance, Stepan Chevanenko and Lev Delyusin, who relished their country's special relationship with China, and hence their own positions as intermediaries between the countries. Khrushchev himself certainly had no such goal in mind. He probably expected a humbled China to come back to the table to renegotiate in terms more amenable to the Soviet Union. But whether he intended to do so or not, Khrushchev's move did contribute to isolating Mao further, hitting him just when reports were coming in from all parts of the country about the effects of mass starvation. In fact, Mao became so depressed in the summer of 1960 that he took to his bed, seemingly incapable of confronting adverse news. He was in retreat, trying to find a way out of the impasse. Chapter 15. Capitalist Grain. Almost immediately after the recall of Soviet experts in July 1960, a triumvirate consisting of Zhu Enlai, Li Fuchun, and Li Xianyan was put in charge of foreign trade. Their answer to Khrushchev's action was to move the trade structure away from the Soviet Union towards the West. By the end of August, Minister of Foreign Trade Ye Jiuquang instructed his representatives abroad to reduce imports from the socialist bloc. All negotiations for new trade agreements were to cease, with the exception of a few strategic projects such as steel from the Soviet Union for the Nanjing Bridge. No new import contracts were to be signed, on the pretext that the price of specifications of the goods on offer were not satisfactory. Some foreign observers at the time talked about a ruthless blockade of China by the socialist camp. But the uncoupling of the economy from the Soviet Union and its allies was entirely initiated by Beijing. However, China could not fob off former trade partners with quibbles about inadequate specifications forever. By December 1960, with Mao in retreat, a more plausible explanation was finally offered. The official version was that China was suffering from unprecedented natural catastrophes which had ravaged a great deal of the countryside, and no more foodstuffs could be exported to the Soviet Union. All trade with the socialist camp had to be reduced, with the exception of Albania. Besides deflecting attention away from the man-made dimensions of the famine, invoking the force of nature had a further advantage. Trade agreements usually carried a standard escape clause, Article 33, stipulating that in the event of unforeseen circumstances beyond human control, part or all of the contract could be terminated. Article 33 was now to be used not only to decrease trade, but to cancel a whole series of agreements. The statistical tables presented in Chapter 10 show that exports to the Soviet Union fell from 761 million rubles in 1960 to 262 million the following year. A similar drop marked imports from Eastern Europe. Only when all arrears with trading partners had been cleared could trade agreements for 1961 be contemplated, Ye Jiuquang explained to his partners in East Berlin. But not only had East Germany become used to rice, it was also dependent on China for edible oils. So large was the shortfall that Walter Ulbricht was forced to turn to Khrushchev for help in August 1961. China moved away from the socialist bloc not as punishment for the withdrawal of Soviet experts, but because it was bankrupt. The best gauge of the country's financial worthiness was the value of the yuan on the black market. It began a spectacular decline in 1960. Then, in January 1961, as news of food shortages leaked out to the rest of the world, it nosedived to an all-time low at about $0.75 per 10 yuan, or about one-sixth of the money's official value. Overall, by June 1961, it had dropped 50% in value from the previous year. Part of the yuan's decline was caused by the need to raise hard currency to pay for grain on international markets. One way of coping with starvation had been to move grain from surplus areas to famished regions, but by the autumn of 1960, as another crop failure worsened the famine, this strategy had very little effect. Zhou Enlai and Chen Yun managed to convince Mao that grain had to be imported from capitalist countries. How they did this remains unclear, but they probably sold the idea by portraying imports of grain as a way to boost exports for cash. The first contracts were negotiated in Hong Kong at the end of 1960. Close to 6 million tons of grain were purchased in 1960-61 at a cost of $367 million. Terms of payment varied. The Canadians asked for 25% down in convertible sterling, while the Australians allowed 10% up front and granted credit on the remainder. But all in all, about half had to be paid in 1961. In order to meet these commitments, China had to earn a surplus in transferable currency, and this could be done only by cutting imports of capital goods and increasing exports to the non-communist world. Throughout the famine thus far, Zhou Enlai had made sure the deliveries of eggs and meat reached Hong Kong every single day. Now, in the autumn of 1960, despite protests from a disgruntled Khrushchev who complained about lack of deliveries to the Soviet Union, he decided to redirect all available foodstuffs towards Hong Kong, greatly increasing trade with the Crown Colony. Cotton and textile products, too, left for Hong Kong, jumping from 217.3 million Hong Kong dollars in 1959 to 287 million Hong Kong dollars the following year. All in all, Hong Kong was the largest source of foreign currency earned during the famine, producing some 320 million US dollars a year. As in 1958, Asian markets were also swamped with cheap goods. Textiles, for instance, were dumped at prices competitors like India and Japan could not possibly match, even when these goods were badly needed on the mainland. Beijing also emptied its reserves, sending silver bars to London. China became an exporter of bullion by the end of 1960, shipping some 50 to 60 million troy ounces in 1961, of which 46 million, valued at 15.5 million pounds, were taken by Britain. In total, if we are to rely on a report by Zhou Enlai, some 150 million US dollars was raised through selling gold and silver by the end of 1961. In a desperate attempt to raise more foreign currency, China also started a grim trade in sympathy by which overseas Chinese could buy special coupons in exchange for cash in Hong Kong banks. These coupons could then be sent to hungry relatives across the border to be exchanged for grain and blankets. Why did China not import grain from its socialist allies? Pride and fear were the main obstacles. As we have seen, the leadership never hesitated to place the reputation of the country above the needs of the population, plundering the countryside to meet export agreements entered into with foreign partners. However, pride often does come before the proverbial fall, and in March 1961, Zhou Enlai had to execute a humiliating climb down, explaining to his trading allies that China was no longer in a position to export foodstuffs, to meet its long-term trade agreements, or to honour a number of contracts for large industrial plants. Over 1 million tons in grain and edible oils was still outstanding to the Soviet Union for the year 1960 alone, and China would not be able to catch up with food shipments in the near future. As Zhou put it diplomatically, how could his country possibly ask for grain when it had failed its socialist allies so badly? Beijing also feared that a request for help might be turned down by Moscow, since the entire Great Leap Forward had been designed to show up the Soviet Union. This fear was probably justified, although initially Moscow displayed goodwill. The Russians, for instance, offered to deliver 1 million tons of grain and 500,000 tons of sugar on an exchange basis, free of interest, the cost to be reimbursed over several years. Beijing turned down the grain, but took the sugar. Khrushchev repeated his offer of grain during a meeting with Yurji Tsvang at the Kremlin in April 1961. He had every sympathy for China's predicament, he told the Minister of Foreign Trade, all the more so since the Ukraine had suffered a terrible famine in 1946. In a crude and rather thoughtless reminder, which could only cause offence, he added that there had even been cases of cannibalism. Then he changed the topic of the conversation, casually mentioning that the Soviet Union was about to overtake the United States in steel production. Yurji Tsvang politely declined the offer. A few months later, as the famine failed to vanish with the arrival of summer, Zhou Enlai approached the Russians again. At a meeting with the delegation from Moscow in August 1961, he explained why, for the first time in